Hello and welcome to Enemies of Good Art. I'm Esther Windsor and I'm chairing today's programme, A Labour of Love, Motherhood as Emotional Capital. This programme explores bad parenting as car crash telly and mothers gone wrong as just part of the media pathologisation of parenting, indicating the spectrum of ideology invested in mothers, and provides a way to look at emotional capital, which is like social capital but of the private sphere. And it's used here to understand mothering, invisible labour, the creation of families and reproduction of social values and class. And with me to discuss this today are Tracy Jensen, Rachel Thompson and Martina Mullaney of Enemies of Good Art, and also Cecily, who's free. Tracy Jensen, who's on the phone with us here. Hello, Tracy. Tracy's a lecturer in Newcastle University and recently published Watching with Hands Over My Eyes. She looks at high concept event television in order to think psychosocially about how and where we do politics in the contemporary media landscape. And also with us here in the studio is Dr. Rachel Thompson, and who's Professor of Social Research at the Faculty of Health and Social Care, the Open University. And her book is called Making Modern Mothers. And also Martina Mullaney, who started the movement Enemies of Good Art after the birth of her daughter. She received an MA in photography from the Royal College of Art in 2004. I'm Esther Windsor. I'm a curator and artist completing a practice-based PhD in fine art at Kingston University, Ugly Beast, a critical study of curating contemporary fine art. So just by way of introduction to how this conversation came about, Martina and I had been talking about how frustrated we felt about mothering not being valued unless it was visible and sexy and accompanied by consumption and signs of success, and also the kind of quite uncomfortable feelings of competition that existed amongst mothers on ideas of success and doing it right. And Martina and I had both struggled to keep art careers and provide as mothers as well. So if we start with you, Rachel, if that's okay, can you tell me a bit about your work and what's useful or not about the term emotional capital?
Okay, well, thank you very much for inviting me. The study that I've been involved with colleagues at the Open University is a large-scale investigation of contemporary mothering. And we met and spoke to about 100 women, all of whom became mothers for the first time at the same time in 2005. And we followed them over a five-year period and talked to grandmothers and partners and sometimes great-grandmothers. Our youngest mother was 15 and our oldest mother was 48, so you can imagine what a range of experience that involves. And I suppose one of the key things that we've tried to work with in the study is the notion that mothering is both something that brings women together, potentially, but also which divides them, and where issues of class difference, difference in taste and culture become really profound, and women may put a lot of energy into distinguishing themselves from other mothers who are not like them, as well as forming solidarities with mothers who are like them in order to survive the experience of motherhood. So that's our study. Emotional capital, really, as I understand it, I'm a sociologist, and it's in my world, it's drawn from the work of Pierre Bourdieu, who's a French sociologist, where emotional capital actually didn't even exist in his original formulation. He came up with a metaphor of capitals which included cultural, social and economic capital. And he used these to explain and explore how privilege is reproduced, really, how those who have privilege manage through culture, tastes, networks, all the invisible stuff of social life to maintain that privilege and pass it on to their children. The term emotional capital really has been an intervention into that framework by feminist theorists who've said, well, where's the work of emotion, of care, the invisible work of the domestic within this? Because Bourdieu didn't talk very much about it, but he relied heavily on that. And some of the work that feminists have done around emotional capital has really looked at why is it that these forms of capital can't be translated. Now, central to Bourdieu's theory was the idea that cultural capital can be turned into economic capital. It can be transferred across fields, whereas emotional capital seems to get stuck. You can't turn it into recognition and value outside of the domestic. And it also gets stuck with women. So this is one of the interesting issues around what is the nature of emotional capital and why it's so closely tied to gender.
Thank you. That's a great introduction to emotional capital. Tracy, can we just go to you to talk a bit about your work?
Yeah, sure. Hi. My work, my research is broadly interested in the explosion of parenting advice culture. So quite different from Rachel's work, I'm interested in the rise of how-to parent guides. And I've looked at some manifestations of this parenting advice culture. And in my work, what I've argued is that these guides have always existed. They've existed for at least two centuries in the form of mothercraft manuals, guides on domestic science, nutrition, Dr. Spock, Gina Ford, all of these kind of familiar names. But that in the past decade, the parent advice culture and parent training texts have exploded. And so I've been interested in this explosion of parental pedagogy and why that's happened. And I've looked at how parenting advice has migrated from books to include things like TV programs and websites, and also how it's migrated from the private sphere to the political sphere. So I'm very interested in the interfaces between politics and culture. We've seen the emergence of a parent pedagogy agenda in policy. So this idea that policy has to address parent training and the ways in which parents conduct their home lives and their children. And what's been interesting in the last decade is that parenting has been increasingly marked out as the cause of social immobility and also as the solution for social immobility as well. So people who don't go on to achieve academic success at school or who go on to be unemployed or have a whole range of other poor outcomes are increasingly seen to do so because of the poor parenting that they must have received. And similarly, children of today are also imagined to be socially included or excluded in the future solely on the basis of the kind of parenting that they receive. So I've been really interested in looking at how this parental pedagogy agenda is now forming the central plank in the current radical restructuring of the welfare state. So in my research, I'm a media scholar, so I know Rachel is a sociologist, so I approach things from a slightly different perspective. And I've looked at some of these manifestations of parent pedagogy. In particular, I looked at a television programme called Super Nanny, which promised kind of popular parent pedagogy over the course of a 50-minute episode. And looking at this programme, it does a lot of the things that we see elsewhere in parental pedagogy culture, parent advice culture. It individualises the difficulties of parenting. So it never talks, Super Nanny, about the lack of affordable childcare or the difficulties of securing flexible part-time work or the motherhood penalty that's experienced by women who want to go back to work after having children. It never talks about money troubles or social isolation. And what it does instead is it recasts the problems of parenting as problems of self-management, poor self-management. So I think if we look at parental pedagogy in this way, and we look at the kind of media representations around parent and parent training, it's always that parents need to be trained. They need to develop emotional competencies. They need to develop skills. And I think if we look more closely at parents watching Super Nanny, we actually find that it's far more complicated than this. So I agree with some of the things that Rachel says in her work about motherhood in particular having a new visibility, but also that it's experienced as a site of social division. And in fact, I would go further and I would say motherhood is the new site for social distinction. It's a place to distinguish oneself from others in producing value and attaching oneself to value. And I guess in terms of emotional capital, that's kind of where I would begin, you know, to think about emotional capital, to think about it as a site for the attachment of social value. And I think that there are useful things. around this concept of emotional capital. As Rachel says, it comes from Pierre Bourdieu, and it comes from this very useful metaphor for social life, thinking about the different kinds of volumes and compositions of value that we might have, that we might be able to trade. And I think the useful thing about capital is that it captures something about how we might trade and exchange and transmit value, different kinds of value. And it also offers us a dynamic metaphor for value and for social class. And it also offers us a useful account of how social power and privilege is consolidated across generations. But I do also have some issues with using the word capital when we think about emotions as well. In that I think capital, there's something that happens when we put the words emotion with the word capital. And I think that changes the meaning of both of those words.
Yeah. If we can come back to that, thank you, that's great. I know we we do have problems with the term emotional capital and its use or not. But can I just ask you, Martina, about your work? I know that your work explores ideas of community and photographic practice, but also, of course, in the formation of enemies of good art as well. And I was wondering what you thought about some of the ideas we're raising about emotional capital and parenting and good parenting, and things that we discussed, I suppose, in our original conversation about this.
Well, when you invited me to join you, I thought that perhaps you needed another academic in the room. But
no.
but in fact, and the fact that we've already had the conversation, or it started with us, I think it's, you know, I'm coming from the point of view of an artist and a mother with a small child. And while I've made work in the past about, I suppose, the lack of community or people who live on their own and feel very isolated and single, and not particularly enjoying the experience of being single. I know that some people feel very fulfilled, but for others it's not a happy time. But I didn't expect that I would feel it after I gave birth. And of course, giving birth itself is quite a lonely experience. But, well, it's the ultimate lonely experience, isn't it? Because you are entirely on your own. But afterwards, in terms of how I might return to practice, how I would organize myself, would I ever make work again? And I, you know, I speak about myself, but I am absolutely, you know, just an example of many of the many thousands of women in London that I'm in, not in contact with all of them, but I know that, you know, I'm constantly getting information from women saying that, you know, they feel the same way. So I speak on behalf of other women when I talk about my particular situation. And it's not that I want to talk about my particular situation, but it's the fact that in terms of, you know, we know it's a thankless job. Nobody ever says thank you to women. Nobody ever says thank you for mothering. Our society doesn't. I'm not sure if it even happens at home. And I suppose this conversation has to take into consideration what happens at home as well, because, you know, so many things, so many situations and problems stem from how women are treated at home. And I've recently become single, so of course it puts a completely different, another level on what's going on in my life. And but apart from that, in terms of practice and in terms of work, I broadcast every Wednesday evening on this show, and I don't want to hog the you know, our airtime, because we've got, you know, amazing women in the studio tonight. But I just, you know, I'm quite interested in you know, emotional capital. I knew nothing about it until we started talking about it. And in fact, it implies in some way that there may be some reward due or possible for the work that we do. But I'd like to know, you know, if anybody has any ideas on how that might come about.
Well, that's how I started to think about it as well. I kind of came across this term and thought, oh, great, you know, there is actually something, there is a kind of transferable value and skill and something that's that can encapsulate the kind of the value, the great kind of work, the labour of love that is kind of mothering. But then I started thinking about, when I was researching it and, you know, kind of Googling it, all the terms that came up were primarily about human resources and the idea of having personal, professional, organisational development skills that are transferable in academic and work kind of context. And I started to feel a bit worried about this. And also, when I then found Tracy's work in emotional capital in the context of parenting and good and bad parenting, and of course bad parenting is very fascinating for all its voyeuristic kind of reasons, but also because, you know, we're deeply kind of anxious and worried about whether we're doing the bad parenting, which Tracy talks really eloquently about in her her paper. But also I was thinking that parenting, this idea of good parenting, has its roots in the back to basics moral crusade of John Major in the mid-90s in the Conservative government, who located the nation within private families rather than communities, echoing kind of Thatcher's infamous phrase that there's no such thing as society. And I started to think about that in relationship to Tracy's work and this idea of locating the difficulty and the shame and irritation that are some of the emotions involved in watching these parenting programs and kind of reading about, you know, these parenting tragedies and the like in the media. And I was wondering, Tracy, would you be able to talk a bit about that and about why, about your work? I was particularly thinking about where you kind of quoted Angela McRaby, where you're talking about ugly feelings and makeover TV and its invitation to post-feminist symbolic violence and the new cruelty.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that's one of the kind of key tropes of parenting advice culture and what, you know, what I sort of call pedagogies. As well, is that there's a kind of new emphasis in parental pedagogy culture on the individual. So the individual is the one who is to affect social change and social renewal for themselves. And so we've moved from a kind of collective responsibility for fairness and for equality to a kind of intensely individualized landscape where it's individuals above all else. So again, kind of echoing what Thatcher said about there's no such thing as society. And I think that's really sort of come to the fore, not just with the present coalition government, but certainly with New Labour as well. They've really made those moves towards that kind of intensely individualised landscape of fairness and equality. And I think a really key component of that is with parenting. So, I mean, I'm a media scholar, so I'm interested in representation and mediations and ideas that circulate in culture. And I think one of those ideas that we can see very clearly in parent pedagogy is that it's above all else the individual nuclear family that is to be held responsible for everything that happens to a child. So there's, you know, the kind of the importance of the school receipts, the importance of local healthcare receipts, the importance of material resources received, and it's just about the kind of competence with which that child is parented. Mm. And I think one of the kind of compelling reasons for watching Supernanny, but also for watching a whole range of kind of media texts which demonstrate this individualising, is that we want to see that we're doing it better. So we want to see other people fail because it makes us feel better about the way that we're parenting. But of course, that never happens, and that's something that really came out in my research, is that although we might watch those programs wanting to see others fail in order to distinguish ourselves as succeeding, of course, there's always moments where we recognize what we see on the screen. And for that reason, I think that there's a real kind of toxic nature to parent pedagogy, in that it's all about internalising that kind of risk discourse and that blame discourse, even though we might be watching it out of our desire to externalise it, to say, look, it's other people that are failing, but of course it's always us as well.
Yeah, absolutely. In your paper you quote Adrienne Rich saying that she was attuned to the potential injury that the institution of motherhood could bring to bear upon mothers, enmeshed within it, the terrible temptation to endure the blame for the impossibility of fantasies of mothering. And then at the end of your paper, you say, until perhaps we are able to watch bad mothers without our hands covering our eyes in shame, refusing to be merely irritated, instead remaining angry, real mothering will continue to lurk on the margins of culture. So I'm wondering, Rachel, maybe you can help us with this, about how useful congealing inequality into a moral issue of in the term emotional capital is, and is it doing that? Is there some value in the term emotional capital?
I'm not certain, to be honest. As I was listening to the conversation, and particularly Martina's point of, you know, is this a thankless task? Is no one interested in this work of parenting? If we, you know, rewind the clock and we go back to the 1970s, this was a really political issue amongst women, and women involved in trade unions, but also radical feminist movements. The now sounds bizarrely named movement of wages for housework was a serious campaign. Mm. The question of who does this invisible labour was really on the political agenda. And at the time, there were two main kind of areas of activism. One was around women and men renegotiating the private and division of labour in the private, or you know, people with their in families, communes, communities, you know, new ways of doing, of sharing the important labour, the collective labour actually of childcare, but also campaigns for the state to socialise that labour and to provide childcare, state-funded education, health, various kind of forms. Now that's, you know, in terms of the contemporary moment, we see a complete assault on the state in terms of those. Not only does that affect women in terms of they are the prime users of those state services, but often they are the workers as well. So they're being hit twice. But there's complete silence really about the politics of sharing. The politics of sharing childcare, of domestic labour, because what everyone thinks now is, well, or particularly those who can afford it, think, well, let's get a cleaner and we won't have any arguments. Mm. And I think the role of the market is the great unspoken, very, very important phenomena that's really changed the agenda. The American sociologist Arlie Hochschild has talked about the idea that there's been a stalled revolution in relation to women's entry into the workforce and the possible transformations that would affect, because rather than those roles being renegotiated, what happened was the market stepped in to provide those services to those who could afford it, and often they were provided by working class women to those who could afford it, which meant the politics went out of the project, and the relationship, women of different backgrounds and different economic backgrounds didn't necessarily then have any solidarity with each other. And very important to her argument is this: when the market goes into the private sphere around childcare, around housework, around these kinds of the domestic invisible emotional labour, it sets standards that are much higher than people would have kept themselves. So there's an inflation of standards, so that the standards are much more than a good enough mother in the past would have done. So things are cleaner, children are, you know, are expected to do music and to do art lessons, and there's this intensification of standards around parenting, which then raises the stakes. But again, the political dimension becomes invisible because people experience themselves, as Tracy was saying, as failing individually to do something, when actually they're really competing with one another, or even more sadly, competing against the market, which is a kind of impossible project. So there's real potential, I think, for repoliticising motherhood. I mean, there's a huge... women have a great deal to gain by politicising this as an area. I mean, there's currently a lot of new kind of feminist activism around issues around pornography and pornification of culture. I think the politics of motherhood are absolutely ripe for a new generation of women to come in and ask really difficult questions about who does the work, who gets rewarded for it, and is it the work of an individual and a family, or is it actually the work of a community and a society?
And it's perhaps rethinking a whole idea of what families are and what motherhood is in a way that is just as radical as the 70s.
Absolutely.
Except the 70s is characterised by more kind of social change and political action, perhaps, than we're experiencing right now. But Martina, you were just...
Well, to kind of pick up on that, I met with someone this morning and she was talking about radical feminism of the 80s and how she met recently as part of a project that she's doing. She's an academic and an artist. And she was, you know, she was quite gobsmacked by the level of intensity and also almost right-wing thinking when it came to the other side, which was men poised or women poised against men. And so therefore, you know, you nearly couldn't have a husband if you were part of this particular group of radical feminists. And of course, we completely understand why that might be the case. But I went out on a march last Saturday with the Fawcett Society. I keep banging on about the Fawcett Society because so many women don't know about the Fawcett Society. Anyway, and we marched from Temple Embankment down to Whitehall. And we ended up with a rally sandwiched between two really high buildings where no one could see us. I'm thinking, why didn't we end the rally in Trafalgar Square? Why did, you know, and motherhood was absolutely on the agenda, as was pornography, as was, you know, we had somebody from the trade union. We had a whole host of women speaking. But I think, you know, one of the speeches was this amazing woman whose name I can't remember right now, but from the Women's Resource Centre, and she was calling on sister resistors. And I was like, okay, so the language again, you know, and it sounds quite funny, but it was great hearing her because this woman was angry and seriously angry. So I think in terms of motherhood, I'm angry. I pushed my way through people with a small child and a scooter to get here. And I didn't bring her buggy because I hate bringing her buggy through rush hour in London. And so I didn't bring it. And so it became slightly more complicated because I couldn't just get quick enough to where I needed to go to be here. So I turned up in a horrible state because it was hot and sweaty. And why is London so bloody hot at the moment? But I thought, I'm going to end up having a massive rant and rave on this show if I'm not careful, because I don't have the responsibility of hosting it tonight and I can behave badly if I want to.
Thanks, Martina.
But in terms of the, you know, the idea of value, how do we convince the other side? Because there's a lot of war happening at home. And so the enlightened few think we've got boyfriends who work part-time or who work, you know, artists. I'm my world is the art world. So a lot of my friends who work freelance and their partners work freelance. And so there's an argument I constantly have with one because everything seems okay in this kitchen. And it's fine. I'm not trying to convince her otherwise. But I know an awful lot of women who, you know, who are not having sex because they're so bloody angry. And they're not having sex because they feel let down in lots of ways. And there is war going on at home. And they're not cleaning the house because when they get 5 minutes in between, you know, the needs of the child, then they're sending emails or trying to get their career going. And absolutely, of course, I am that woman. But you know, and so I think while there's domestic war taking place, of course it's going to manifest itself in all areas of our society. But I'm not a sociologist or a scholar yet to be able to argue this. But just, you know, in terms of the research that I've been doing and the sheer amount of women I've met an enormous amount of unhappy, frustrated women who think everything was all right at home until they had a kid.
Yeah, well, I think it's really important, you know, to point out that you have actually created a community. You have actually kind of
what does that even mean anymore? I don't know. I mean, I'd like to think somehow.
What's community and who the other side are?
But you know, it would be great. I would love to feel part of a community. I'd love to feel, you know, that in some way, you know, a gang of us could live in a big house and support and love each other. But of course, society has become so divided and individualistic, like we've just been talking about. But I've given the illusion, or I'd like, you know, somehow some women think that now there's a conversation happening around art practice because I'm an artist. And basically, mostly we talk about how the hell you practice after you've had a child, because most of us don't necessarily have a paid job to go to. So it's how you generate the work, how you make the work, how you get the headspace.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a more intense kind of problem with mothering and an art career because of the already kind of economic marginalisation and kind of disenfranchisement that we feel. And I suppose that the kind of community that you created through Enemies of Good Art, actually I was going to say it's a kind of symbolic community, but it isn't. It is actually an actual kind of community, because people are linked together and talk together and support each other, and things do happen. So I would
there's an awful lot of work to be done, though.
A community.
Can I just make a comment, really? in terms of your frustration and the way in which, without, I don't want to kind of stereotype you, but in terms of there's a certain kind of trajectory for women who probably have competed on a level playing field in their family. They were probably treated equally to the brothers. They probably can, well, but you know, as a sort of a bigger picture, in at school probably got equal access at school, were able to probably maybe the first generation in their family to go to university got equal access, entering the labour market also a sense of equal access, and then suddenly you have a baby and dunno, you suddenly discover what it means to be a woman. And that things are not equal. And when Tracy was talking about the motherhood penalty, this is very much the way in which middle-class women discover it. It's, you know, it happens much later than it might have happened a generation previously, because they're in education, they're in, they see themselves as competing equally. And Angela McRobbie, a sociologist, has talked about this idea of the new sexual contract, where, you know, women have to exchange the right to be angry, to be feminist, for the right to compete on equal playing field. And so when they get to the situation where they suddenly discover, you know, that they're a woman, that they, things are not fair at all, that they're going to be given this unfair burden, they're a long way into their life. They're a long way into their career. Whereas perhaps working class girls and women might discover this when they're 18. They might discover that life's unfair. But that's one of the reasons why it's really hard to create solidarities. And, you know, Tracy's work on reality TV, it's not only is it hard to create solidarities, but there's popular culture there inciting divisions the whole time between women to make it really difficult for them to connect to each other.
Yeah, those kinds of television texts are kind of constantly undermining. They reproduce unexpected sites of solidarity, but they're also constantly undermining them as well. And I just wanted to make a quick point about what kinds of emotions it's possible to express within feminism more generally, but also certainly as mothers. I mean, I think one of the interesting points that you've raised with this idea of emotional capital, Esther, is that, you know, it kind of gestures to the ways perhaps that emotions are hierarchically ordered, so there's a hierarchy of emotions, and what that means is that certain emotions are marked as more desirable or more expressible, whilst other ones become unspeakable or unsayable. And I think in some ways, you know, the idea of emotional capital is, you know, it is accessible in contemporary culture, but it's a particular kind of emotional capital. And what you were saying just then, Rachel, about Angela McRobbie's work around the future being female, for example, and I know in your work you talk about labourised mothers, about mothers being treated first as workers and only then as mothers. I think there's something about emotional capital in terms of why it emerges at this moment, which is, you know, absolutely associated with work and with the feminisation of work. You know, work in the kind of current landscape is, you know, precarious. It's contract work, it's punctuated by unemployment. We kind of exist in a continual state of underemployment. And I think emotional capital in that respect speaks to a certain kind of resilience. So what we're really talking about when we talk about emotional capital is the ability to absorb setbacks, the ability to see opportunities, the ability to persist in periods of unemployment and material challenge. And I think that's something that's absolutely associated with the kinds of motherhood penalties that working mothers have to negotiate after they have a child and try and balance that with the demands of work.
Absolutely. Yeah, yes, very much, yeah. And of course, you know, the idea of, you know, capital, you know, has come back to this, you know, idea of class and who the other side is. And I guess what we're saying is the other side is the market. Would that be correct? Am I being really crude?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, yes, but I think it's not so easy to, I mean, to think of, you know, in some ways the ways the liberation of women has been the market as well, in terms of opportunities to get rid of domestic drudgery and for childcare to become sociable, to become, there's been many ways in which the market's been a great friend of women, as well as being a sort of double-edged sword for them. But can I just bring in another sort of theme around emotional capital which relates to schooling and women's role as the primary kind of negotiators of the schooling system for children, because I think that's one of the key areas where emotional capital is absolutely central and is exercised and is really complicated. And I think actually where there's a huge amount of suffering takes place. And it is at work that's primarily done by mothers. So it's the worrying, the thinking about education. And the sociologist Diane Ray has written really interestingly about emotional capital in relation to education and looking at all of that emotional labour that's done by mothers. And she talks really fascinatingly about there being a very fine line between empathy and anxiety, and that in many cases working class parents really struggle to be able to support their kids in relation to getting the best out of education, because they are unable to stop themselves falling into anxiety. And they whereas middle class parents often have more skills to stay over the side of around empathy and are able to do this kind of emotional labour that manages to work the system in the to the advantage of their children, as opposed to experiencing intense anxiety in relation to their children failing at school. So I don't know if that's another area that you'd like to talk about, because I think it's probably one of the biggies for mothers and one of the great worries, especially living in London.
Yes, it is huge. My heart's pounding as we speak. My daughter's just started school and I've experienced all of those realisations that it doesn't help to get anxious and upset, and you've just got to be kind of really strategic and clever about getting what you want, and you know, checking out kind of what the other successful mothers are doing. And it's horrible. It's, you know, just really kind of awful. I thought school might be kind of, you know, quite liberating and a place of consolidating kind of social groups and making kind of new friends, but I experience I don't necessarily kind of experience it like that at the moment. It's very new kind of territory for me. It's kind of weeks old. What about you, Martina?
Well, I'm at the point where I have to decide what part of London or indeed England I'm going to live in soon, so that I can live within spitting distance of a school that I'd like her to be in. And I've had a friend who's a single mother who left her house in Angel, a flat that she owned, and moved half a mile away to be in the catchment area of a school. And it took her more than 6 months to do so, quite a bit of money and an enormous amount of stress, just to get this pokey tiny flat so that she might get her kid into the school. And her little fella's dad is not in the country, so she deals with this all by herself. And of course she's that bracket of women that, you know, well, if things go wrong in our society, apparently single mothers are to blame for the recent riots, because single mothers, you know, don't do a good job in terms of parenting. But to get back to the idea of schooling, I don't know, because I'm secretly dreading it. I quite fancy her being in an all-girls school, but I don't know, because I have to get round that. And very personally, I'm going to be the one getting round it. But I think, you know, we did a show called Immersive Parenting, where we, Cecily, I can't give you those because they're too loud. She's looking for. Oh, look at pink pen. Ooh, don't write on the walls. Ed Baxter will chuck me out of here unceremoniously. There you go. But the show we did on immersive parenting, where we're talking about homeschooling, and two women, you know, talked about schooling their children, and both of their eldest children were six at the time, so they'd already had a couple of years into it. And I asked about control, and if control was a part of the whole process, or perhaps even, you know, an attraction to the idea of homeschooling. And they both had to agree that it was, to a degree. But it also seemed like a really radical move to somehow opt out of that system that pits women against others, or creates the anxiety that you're talking about.
But surely the state state schooling, comprehensive schooling doesn't pit, in itself, doesn't pit mothers against each other. But it is a system that requires cooperation, solidarity and altruism to thrive. And I think that's one of the things that's the impacts of policies of school choice has introduced quite deliberately mistrust into a system, or created the appearances of a market and choice where there actually is no choice and there is no market, in fact. But there's enormous mistrust, and people feel that they can fail by sending their kids to the local school, which a generation previously they wouldn't have been thinking, and they wouldn't have been operating in that highly individualised way.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, and just in my kind of brief experience of it, and also, yeah, I mean, I didn't say, because I'm quite ashamed of it, but I mean, I moved to be near the school I wanted to get my daughter into, which is a top-rated non-denominational school, and even though I lived 2 minutes away, I still didn't get in. So I went to church for 3 years to get her into the Church of England school, which she did, and now she's there. And I probably shouldn't be saying this on air.
Yes,
I might get kicked out of school already. But now realise that partly it doesn't matter. You're handing your child over to the state, that's it. And, you know, they will be socialised by this kind of state system. And secondly, that do I spend all my time, not kind of working in a kind of corporate culture and questioning academically, emotionally, socially, in every possible, aspect of my life, what kind of being a normal mother is, or kind of how to kind of question social kind of class, or a number of things that one might do as an artist or an academic.
I do
to
want
just
to
dump my child into a new ideological system, which I've got nothing, I don't believe in. I've got nothing, no control over.
That conversation wasn't solely the reasons for homeschooling. Wasn't about the potential situation of women being pitted against each other. It was more to do with not wanting to be part of the whole state machine.
Mm. Yeah, but what I find is that women incorporate those values of what it is to have proper schooling, even if they're things they didn't actually enjoy or endorse in their own education. So they're kind of like this, I don't know, going to a religious school and praying, or the kind of strictness of how one behaves. So we're reproducing things that we've spent actually maybe 20 years criticizing because we don't have a choice, or do we have the choice of homeschooling and they're not working, they're not doing the work that we spent so long trying to do.
But I also think we're out of practice as a culture at collectivity, doing things collectively, trying to influence a school, becoming involved and trying to make the school reflect more closely what the community is, and also there being a really diverse community. I always think London's fascinating that everyone embraces diversity. They love living in diverse neighbourhoods. They love working in diverse workplaces, but they really don't like sending their kids to diverse schools. I think that's really, really interesting. And if we're talking about emotional domains of parenting, that's something that might not be very easy to start unpicking, but it's very important to start unpicking. What is it about those kinds of differences when they're projected onto children, the ways in which we do project some of ourselves onto our children and then send them off? Why is that not okay when it's okay for us in lots of other ways?
And I think it does come back to this idea about anxiety, about failing or absorbing one's own ugly feelings and not kind of really confronting them. And I was wondering, Tracy, if you could talk about the end of your paper, the one you're watching with my hands over my eyes, and in your conclusion, your conclusion's called "Ugly Feelings in the Post-Feminist Maternal Subject." And sorry, we kind of got you there and now ranting because you were on the phone. But do come back in.
I was waiting for a point to jump in. I think ugly feelings are kind of the other side of this idea of emotional capital. I think what's interesting about feelings and what's interesting about emotions is that emotions aren't just private. They're not just individual, subjective. They're not just lived in the space of the inner life. They're also cultural and social entities, and the emotions that we feel depend upon the ways in which we're culturally situated and socially situated in all sorts of ways. So I think what's interesting for me in terms of the ways in which emotional capital is taken up is that it's often taken up, and I'm not talking about feminist researchers, some of which Rachel's referred to, but I'm talking about the ways in which the idea of emotional capital is taken up in policy, is it's taken up in a very sort of rationalised and commodified way, in terms of therapeutic culture, in terms of doing work on yourself. And I think parenting advice culture is an example of a consumer market which has commodified emotions. And I think the other side of that is these kind of ugly feelings, these things that might be unspeakable, unsayable, the kind of less noble emotions, things like envy and frustration and even rage. And I think it's interesting to think about this in terms of schooling, because I think actually schooling is one of those places where the concept of emotional capital doesn't work for me. You were talking earlier about making choices over which schools you go to and going through certain processes to try and exercise choice over those school, the kind of school destination for your children. And I think that's an example of me of how capital is not emotional. It's absolutely material. It's economic. It's about being able to rent a house near the school that you want to get a place at. It's about social capital. It's about knowing which kinds of networks you might be able to speak to. And it's also educational capital as well. The kind of confidence to enter the school with a sense of entitlement is a kind of educational capital. But I think the kind of the worrying work and the thinking work and the emotional work, the emotional labour that's done by mothers is very hard to translate into value. It's very hard for that to be kind of recognised socially. And that's why I don't think that schooling, for me, operates as an example of emotional capital. But I just wanted to say as well that I think the first moment when your child goes to school is often, and unless they've been to preschool or nursery care, is that first time when we're doing something socialised, childcare. And I think that's why it's such a kind of political hot potato. Schooling, it's kind of that time when you pass your child over into this kind of unknowable institution which operates according to rules that you can't always necessarily influence. So I think it's a really interesting kind of political point where that kind of socialised childcare that Rachel was talking about earlier becomes realised to some degree.
Yeah.
Add to that, I think, sort of sadly, motherhood can be a very conservative moment in our lives because it's kind of, at some level, it's a destination point for us. We kind of feel we got to this place, and then we're creating a new generation, and then the project is to try and help the next generation get to some place. So we've got to a destination in terms of social mobility. May not be where we want to be, but at some level it's a destination, and there's a new project that takes place. And I think, you know, the big context, the broader context at the moment is one of downward social mobility for the squeezed middle class, widening inequality between the very rich and the increasingly large group of people, you know, people called the precariat, working in precarious work, struggling to get state services for education and health. There is a group for whom there really isn't too much anxiety, emotional anxiety about parenting, because they delegate the task. You know, they put their children down for eating when they're born, and it's quite a pragmatic decision that project is delegated and paid for and bought and in highly institutionalised ways. It's really the middle class and the working class who experience anxiety around these things, because they're trying to somehow use their own resources, their emotional resources, to create value in their children. Whereas, as Tracy was saying, I mean, at one level, it is a very straightforwardly economic project if you've got the assets. And I think the struggle of trying to turn emotional capital into material capital in the context of recession and a broader process of downward social mobility is increasingly difficult and increasingly competitive.
I wonder if by talking about emotional capital, we're deflecting, exactly as you say, attention from other kinds of capital, which have a much more immediate effect on things like social mobility and equality of opportunity. So, I mean, it's interesting that we're living in a time now where, you know, there's enormous, radically restructured public sector. You know, we've got all these cuts, a reorganised welfare state, all kinds of resources that we would use as mothers, sure start centres, libraries, subsidised and free activities that are organised through local councils, you know, are being cut at a rate which is, you know, kind of completely unanticipated. So all of these things that previously, you know, would have been open for babies and young children of all mothers, in theory, are being, you know, kind of radically reduced and in some cases disappearing. And I wonder if this is the time to talk about emotional capital, or if in fact we should revisit Pierre Bourdieu's other kinds of capital, or even say, let's not talk about social capital, let's not talk about cultural capital, let's just talk about capital, economic capital. Let's talk about resources and, you know, the kind of material inequalities and the, you know, material and economic landscapes that we inhabit differently. So a part of me wants to say, let's not talk about capital at all. Let's not complicate capital, let's just talk about money.
Is this another instance of making something, turning something into the symbolic that is actually the material?
But it may be, the reason that it's at the fore may be because there's a form of asset stripping going on in the middle classes who don't have material capital, but they do have cultural capital. And emotional capital may be the way in which that asset stripping is being expressed. So, you know, people are using whatever they've got to try and secure advantage for their children. And emotional capital is the way that we see that happening. So it's not just a question of, oh, it's a, you know, we shouldn't be using it, but it's interesting that that's the tone. And it's not just the tone in discussions like this, as Tracy was saying, it's the you switch on the TV, it's the tone. You listen to David Cameron, it's the tone. It's the mode in which we're talking. And that's always like we have to treat that as a symptom of something and try and work out what it is that's going on behind it. And I think it is. It's a squeeze on, you know, what was a relatively big, secure middle class in this country, which is really going to be squeezed.
Yeah, and you have this great phrase in your book, Rachel, where you say we can predict the trends towards privatisation of childbirth are set to continue and accelerate with the mompreneur as a key figure of pushing forward the commodity frontier into the lucrative domestic interiors of the middle-class families. We expect greater divisions between women on the basis of social class to harden as families seek to defend their children against downward social mobility, monopolising the best in state provision or opting into private provision where necessary, and the spaces in which mothers mix are likely to diminish as state provision is reduced and targeted on the most disadvantaged. Well, one would hope it's being.
Yeah.
There's some left.
That's so depressing.
I know.
But of course, there are other ways. I mean, there are other ways of things going, and people can be inventive and creative. And Martina was saying before, you know, I don't know why people don't get together as share houses and share childcare and things like that. We may see the development of new kinds of forms of family as a result of people's creative responses to these difficulties, which would be really fantastic. So it's not simply a case of increasingly individualised suffering. I think there probably has to be some creative response to the current situation.
And I think creative is the key word there. And I'm full of anecdotes, but I have I know a mother who was trying to set up a communal studio that we could all take care of each other's kids. And so you would spend... Esther's got something for you. You would spend so much time looking after the children and get free studio space in return, and you pay a nominal fee. But she just couldn't do it. By the time she got through all the paperwork and tried to, you know, just try to coordinate a group of 10 to 12 mothers, she's like, it somehow it didn't come off. So I think, you know, in terms of our creativity, yes, we're going to have to get pretty damn creative to be able to get around this one, because we are so regulated as well that it's pretty it's difficult then to actually get past a lot of the hurdles.
Yeah.
But also Cecily's having enough now. But also how do we get through all that to be able to support each other? I think it's a big question. Of course, I have no answers for because I'm in the thick of it. But you know, people are talking about communal living, and in Germany, in Berlin, one of our colleagues on Enemies of Good Art broadcasts from Berlin for us, and she's going to do a show on this because apparently, it's much more usual to get together as groups with kids. Either in any form of family situation, whether it be single parent or single sex or, you know, group, the traditional nuclear family. So I'm quite interested to see what she's going to come up with there.
Because shared housing in this country tends to end when people form couples and have children. It's a feature of that period of life. People might do it again post-divorce. But it's kind of seen that the whole notion of children and settling is about individual nuclear families and separate housing.
Mm. Yeah, this idea of you know, class and morals going kind of hand in hand is very strong. You know, that, and is it being part of a kind of Judeo-Christian culture where the idea of marriage is still very kind of paramount, it's very kind of central, and with all the encumbrant kind of culture and expectations that go along with it. Yeah, when I hear Martina talk about alternatives, I think, well, actually, historically, there have been alternatives as well. You know, have we forgotten kind of, you know, what's happened in history? You know, things like housing co-ops and cooperative childcare. But
London,
we fall back to some default place.
In London, and you've raised the question of London, it has its own set of problems.
Mm.
Because property is so expensive and everybody's vying for the same, you know, corner that might be a little bit more reasonable than others. It's not impossible, I don't think, but it does seem like quite an insurmountable task at the moment. Because I'm looking for that cooperative type situation would be quite perfect.
Yeah. So
and we've talked
how
about
to get
it often
to kind
enough.
Of make that is for sure another.
So
program,
if anybody's listening and they'd like to send in suggestions, info@enemiesofgoodart.
Yes. I'd just like to finish by quoting Rachel in her book Making Modern Mothers, where she says that motherhood is ripe for another round of politicisation, and hopes that her book contributes to the project of forging a new and invigorated politics of motherhood, providing insights into why solidarities are so difficult yet potentially so rewarding and necessary. And I'd just like to echo that. And this talk has, thank you very much, everyone, has helped me understand better and problematise the idea of emotional capital. But I think I like the idea of ugly feelings more. So thank you, Tracy, in Newcastle, and Rachel and Martina from Enemies of Good Art. And just to say, this is the first part of a discussion on emotional capital, and the second part will be in 2 weeks' time, looking at psychoanalysis and politics in emotional capital on the 7th of December. So I hope that you'll join us on the regular Enemies of Good Art slot at 6:30 to 7:30. And thank you for listening. Thank you.